Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Keith Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate the support. If you want to connect with me, the website is theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can find information about books and podcasts and all that good stuff. Or if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do so at Macroaggressions. Instagram, at MacroaggressionsPod. At Macroaggressions Podcast, I think, technically. Anyway, Tony manages that. You can have some fun with him over there if you want. Hey, thanks to our sponsors that make this show possible. Chemical Free Body has been with us from the beginning. They are making fantastic supplements that actually work. You can go take a look at their Green 85 products. You'll like that. I take a glass of that every single morning without fail. It's just 12 ounces of water, a scoop of green powder, mix it up, drink it. Doesn't taste that bad. It looks like it's going to taste really bad, but it actually tastes way better than it looks. And I'll tell you what, it'll make you feel better. You got to do this. You got to help yourself get healthy. Nobody's coming to save you. Nobody's coming to fix your diet. Nobody's coming to do any of that. It's going to be about you. So if you made the decision that you want to get healthy and you want to try some supplement products that actually work, Chemical Free Body is a good place to go over there and get started. You can find Pat Miletich's supplement he's got called Super Soldier over there. I haven't tried that one yet, but I will. Hopefully I will. Hopefully it won't cause me to grow a third arm. I doubt it will, because I think I trust Tim a whole lot, and Pat too. So take a look. Chemicalfreebody.com is the place to go. If you find something that you like the detox bundle, just use the promo code MACRO on your way out, and it'll save you a bunch of money. And they have free shipping all over the United States on big orders. So take a look. Chemicalfreebody.com, promo code MACRO. Also, thanks to Legal Shield, they have been in business for half a century. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They're available in the United States and Canada. It just gets you access to a lawyer in your area, a really good one, for a reasonable price, a dollar a day. I mean, wow. You spend a dollar a day on all kinds of nonsense. But to have access to an attorney in your area with, on average, 22 years of experience that can help you navigate the minefields that are set for us that we need help with. And as little guys like us, you don't have access to a big attorney, but you do now. So that changes. So if you are interested, you can go to the website that's created specifically for this show, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com. And on that page, you can see all the things that Legal Shield has to offer. It's not just the legal plan. There's also a la carte items that you can add on if you want, if you run a small business. And you need the small business legal plan, they've got that. If you are somebody that carries a gun and you need the paperwork and documentation for that, check it out. They've got that covered for you as well. If you just need the ID shield to help you out with credit monitoring, reputation management, password manager, all that stuff, it's available. It's all over there. So you can just add this to your Legal Shield membership, which is $29.95 a month. That's pretty reasonable. If you don't have your documents in order, your will, your power of attorney for medical and financial, get them done. Knock that out in the first month. You might as well. It'll pay itself off. This whole service will pay itself off for the next several years if you just make one visit to your attorney and get all your legal documents sorted out. But again, moving forward, work wants you to sign some weird new employment arrangement, that employment contract that has a language about injections and medical procedures that you agree to take to continue working there. And you go, I don't really like this. This seems weird. Send it to your attorney. If you get pulled over by the police, speeding tickets, red light cameras, whatever, parking ticket, send it all to your attorney. Just let them deal with it. They can knock that stuff out real easy. It's easy for them. It's hard for us, but it's easy for them. So take a look. Thank you to Legal Shield. Don'tgetpushedaround.com is the website if you need it. Well, I'll tell you, I want to do an episode on the Saudis because they're big players. They have been for a while, but things are different there now. Things have changed. And they used to be sort of the, American little brother in the Middle East. We had this arrangement with the petrodollar where we basically said to them in the 70s, you price your oil in only dollars, meaning you'll only sell your oil to any country in US dollars. That means if you're Saudi Arabia and you're selling your oil to Turkmenistan, Turkmenistan needs to pay for it with US dollars. Okay. So if you understand that that's the relationship that the United States crafted with Saudi Arabia, what that does is it creates demand for US dollars where there might not have been demand for US dollars. Now, maybe Turkmenistan had a couple million US dollars sitting in a vault somewhere, but now they need to have a couple billion of it. Because if they intend to buy oil in this arrangement, I don't think Turkmenistan needs Saudi's oil, but whatever. As an example, you know, you get it. You create an artificial demand for a product, US dollars, that didn't exist before. So it's a good deal for the US. It's a fucking great deal for the US. And in exchange, what you say to Saudi Arabia is, look, we'll protect you. You can get in, do whatever you need to do in your region, which is a dangerous region to be in, where you're sort of surrounded by a bunch of other countries that don't exactly get along with you, maybe have some problems with your kingdom and have related, you know, issues that could come up in the future, and you might need our help. We're essentially your big brother that will come and stuff anybody that gets in your way into a locker and keep them there. So that arrangement works for a while, worked great for us. A lot of people made a lot of money on it, especially the Bush family and these Rockefellers and the likes. Anyone that was in the oil business in America was just made a fortune. And this arrangement with Saudi Arabia lasted for a while, and it was very lucrative for all involved. But times have changed. Times have changed, and the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia has definitely changed over the years. So I think it's worth a look now to see kind of what Saudi Arabia had been, what they wound up becoming now, you know, where this transition with Mohammed bin Salman in charge. Now, what are we doing? What's the relationship with China? You know, it's worth an examination. So well, let's start at the beginning. Let's start at a personal. Have you guys ever seen the movie The Kingdom? It's a great movie. I'm not just saying that because my buddy wrote it, but it's a great movie about what happens in Saudi Arabia. I went to college with a guy named Matt Carnahan who wrote it, and I have kind of a funny non-related to Saudi Arabia story, but I have to tell it because it's the only Matt Carnahan story I have. Shout out to Matt if you're out there. He's a good dude. We were in summer school in college, not because we were in detention or anything like that, but it was like I signed up for summer classes so that I could get the fuck out of that school as fast as I could so I could wrap up 4 years of school in 3.5 years, you know, so I wanted to get done. So I was on campus, or I was living off campus, but in the area during summer. And there's nothing going on during summer on the campus, right? So we went out to drink. I went out for dinner and drinks with some friends, two other guys, one of them being Matt. And we wound up back at Matt's fraternity house, which had nothing going. There are no students there, but there was plenty of action going on because they were filming a movie at their fraternity house during the summer because nobody's really there. Eight heads in a duffel bag, right? And we're like, what a crazy name for a movie that is. So we go out, we come back, we're a little drunk. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning. We're up in this the big room up at the top of the stairs. And we don't even hear the door. Nobody even knocks on the door. The door just opens up. And I'm looking across the room and I'm like, God damn. Mind you, this is 1994. Just to kind of put this in perspective of everything. I look around, I go, and this guy goes, "What the fuck is going on in here? What are you guys doing in here?" And I was like, "Is that Joe Pesci?" And it was Joe Pesci had walked into this room completely unannounced with the biggest bodyguard I've ever seen in my life behind him. And so the juxtaposition of Joe Pesci being the small little guy and this bodyguard behind him, who's like his buddy, 94, right? So we're talking 4 years after Goodfellas and right around that casino era, right? So I'm watching this and Joe Pesci walks in the room. He goes, "What's going on in here?" And we're like, "I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm on acid. That's what's going on in here, you know?" And he's like, "What are you guys doing?" We're like, "Well, we just came back from going out." He goes, "Does anybody have any porno mags?" And we're like, "What?" And he's like, "Do you guys have any porno mags?" I was like, "This isn't my room. I don't live here. I don't know, maybe, but I'm not in charge of them." He's like, "The fuck good are you then?" I'm like, "I'm not good for anything right now. What is happening?" He's like, "Well, you guys are worthless. I came up here to get some porno mags and you guys don't have any. So you guys have a good night." And he just left. So that's my Matt Carnahan story. Guy who wound up later going on to write The Kingdom. It just was one of those random things that happened. So years later, Matt's like, I wrote the script for this movie. It came out. You should watch it. I watched it and it's brilliant. And I'm not just saying it because it's him, you know, not because he's a friend. It's about Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is a really interesting place, you know. So let's do a little dive on the history of it. Kind of like what's not we're not going to go back like 300 years, but just kind of the recent history and how things were and why they were. And when they changed and kind of where we're going, because I think it's really important if we're going to understand this. You don't have to be an American or a Saudi to have an interest in where this is going, because these guys are going to play a big role in the world moving forward. And I think it's imperative for all of us to know what this relationship and what this play is. And full disclosure, I'm not entirely certain how this thing is going to end. I just know where it's going right now. So there's going to be some opportunities for us to speculate about what the House of Saud has planned for the world moving forward. But here's a spoiler alert. It ain't going to be involving the United States for much longer. And that's going to cause some issues. So let's talk about Saudi Arabia. There's 36 million people there, and it's 85% of them are living in urban areas. 20% of the entire country lives in the capital of Riyadh. So it's very desert-ish, obviously. I grew up in a desert area. I know what that's like. There's a whole lot of nothing. And there's regions for whatever reason that sort of group up people into it. So you've got major cities, but the vast majority of Saudi Arabia is just desert and sort of uninhabitable. It's three times the size of Texas, if that kind of puts it in perspective. And if you've ever driven through Texas, you know that there's a whole lot of nothing out in Texas as well. So Saudi Arabia is number one in oil exports. They export 7.4 million barrels of oil every single day. Okay. That's a pretty good operation that you've got there. If you're able to export something that the entire world needs and you're the number one exporter of it, you're going to be relevant. You're going to be important. You're going to be needed. You're going to always be a player on the world stage because the world needs something from you. They need you to price it accordingly. They need you to refine it, distribute it, make sure that they have access to it consistently without any sort of supply chain gaps, i.e. look what's going on with Europe and the Russians' oil getting cut off there. So you've got to make sure that the oil company, meaning Saudi Arabia, is always open for business. It can't get invaded. It can't be bogged down in some sort of civil war. It can't be fighting with its neighbors. It can't have any of that stuff going on because you're going to need stability there. And for a long, long time, Saudi Arabia has been relatively stable. You know, I mean, an iron fist has been ruling it that is connected to a very real large sword that removes heads from bodies all the time in the town square. And you can see it videoed. The video footage of it, it's pretty fucking gory, but they keep things in line over there for better or for worse. Number two in oil production. So number one in exports, number two in production. How much do they produce? They produce 10.8 million barrels per day. So they export 7.4 million of them, but they produce 10.8. So there's a gap there. There's 3 million, 3.4 million barrels a day that are not being exported. They're being held by the Saudis, used by the Saudis for sure, used to fuel their own operations, but also retained and held on to in case they need it. So they're also number two in proved reserves, which means that moving forward, they're going to be fine. Unless Joe Biden pivots to the Green New Deal, which ain't happening. But the amount of proved reserves that Saudi Arabia has is 258.6 billion barrels. Okay. So you could do the math on that. They produce 10.8, but let's just round up. They produce 11 million barrels a day and they've got 258 billion barrels underground. So again, they're going to be fine for a while. The country itself borders Iraq, Jordan, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. And if you know what's been going on in Yemen over the last couple of years, it's been a humanitarian nightmare. And what the Saudis have done to the Yemeni people is reprehensible. To do what they're doing to the poorest country on earth is horrible and unfortunately expected. We're not dealing with a ton of compassion in this region. Okay, let's talk about OPEC. This is really important. This is a group that. They get talked about a little bit in the news. It's been around for a while. It started in 1960. It stands for the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, acronyms. It began with Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Venezuela. And then since then, they've added additional members. There's now 13 members of OPEC officially. There's the OPEC Plus, which I guess is like CNN Plus, except it didn't go out of business and lasted more than 3 weeks and didn't cost $250 million. OPEC Plus is 10 other oil producers that joined. They joined in 2016, including Russia. Isn't that weird? Yeah, that throws a big monkey wrench in everything too. When you're supposed to hate Russia and sanction Russia and have this big problem with Russia, and it's like, yeah, but they're a member of OPEC Plus. Now, what do we want to do with them? Like, I don't know. Keep that on the down low. We need the oil. So OPEC Plus produces 10 million Russia produces 10 million barrels a day as well. So you've got Saudi Arabia and Russia both producing a ton of oil every single day. So if you want to slap sanctions on Russia, that's fine, but just understand they can print money forever because they've got oil for it. And that's going to be a huge problem because if you sanction Russia and they're part of OPEC Plus, well, OPEC Plus is responsible for the production of 40% of the world's crude oil. So you're talking about the lifeblood of this planet currently. Eventually we'll get onto something else that isn't oil, but as we stand right now, and we have to function in reality right now, oil's the thing, you know. I don't love it. I wish that we were using clean energy technology, not the bullshit stuff that Biden talks about, but the actual cleaner energy production. It would take the power away from a lot of these people, a lot of these countries. But and one day we'll eventually pivot to that. But for now, we have to deal with the current paradigm, and the current paradigm is oil. No matter how many times Kamala Harris wants to talk to you about electric school buses and Karine Jean-Pierre wants to lie to you about how Biden's new Green Deal energy is going so well, even though California's grid shuts down during the summer and can't handle normal charging, let alone 8 million electric cars getting charged at the same time. It's a catastrophe. It's not going to happen. It's going to fall apart. And we're going to be dependent on oil for a little bit longer, whether we like it or not. So we better understand who's in charge of the oil. And that's Saudi Arabia and Russia. Okay, so by all means, Joe Biden, stop picking fights with both of them, you dumb old pedophile. So let's talk about this. Saudi Arabia voluntarily cut their production by 1 million barrels per day. And that really spooked the Biden administration. They freaked out, especially because they freaked out, right? But we did it, or Saudi did it right before the midterm elections. And Biden put a call in or something saying, you know, you can't do this to us right before the midterm elections. This is going to make us look bad. And Mohammed bin Salman just said, take a message. I'm not talking to that old guy. Who gives a fuck what he thinks, right? They voluntarily cut their production. And but part of this is because it gets back to the supply and demand reality, which is the more of a, the demand for oil is always there. It's just, it's really more about supply. How much are you going to supply? If you have the ability to supply like endless amounts of oil, well, then every barrel of oil has less value because there's there's an unlimited supply. So what Saudi Arabia likes to do is play around with the not the necessarily the pricing so much. They just and they can't do anything about the demand really, but they can control the supply. They can control how much they pull out of the ground and how much they refine. And with that, if they choose to pull out of the ground a smaller amount and refine a smaller amount, then the price of every barrel of oil will go higher because there is a smaller amount out there for acquisition. It's just basic supply and demand. The Saudis need oil to be above $80 a barrel. These are the reports that we're getting from people that know the industry. I don't know the oil industry as well as, well, I don't know it as well as I should. I don't know it as well as the oil experts for sure. The oil experts are all saying, in sort of a non-political way, Saudi Arabia needs about $80 a barrel for oil. In order for all of MBS's dreams for a Saudi future to come true, it's going to need to be priced about there. Currently, it's in the low 70s a barrel. Okay, so if you understand this, they're going to need about 15%, 10 to 15%. Of a price increase just to get these ideas off the ground. And who's in charge of that? Well, let's get into this. Let's get into who runs the oil company in Saudi Arabia. You might be surprised because it is really the Americans. I mean, the Saudis are in charge of it all, but when it comes to the mechanics of pulling it out of the ground and refining it, the Americans were the ones that had that technology that really brought that to the table. And the idea was to create a joint venture between the Saudis and the Americans. And they did that called the Arabian American Oil Company, otherwise known as Aramco. Now, Aramco got on my radar when I was in high school. I was in boarding school. And the reason why it did was because the education system in Saudi Arabia ends after ninth grade, apparently. This is what I'm told. And that the kids, the American kids that grew up in Dhahran, the city where Aramco is based, had to kind of figure out what they were going to do for schooling. And so a lot of them were sent off to boarding schools in the 10th grade. That's why I know this, because at the boarding school where I was, we got a lot of Americans from Saudi Arabia, not Saudis. I never met a single person, an Aramco kid, who was Saudi. They were all American, white Americans, but they were coming from Saudi Arabia. And we had a ton of them there. So I knew about Aramco back in the 80s because of this unusual relationship. And look, it's a big one too. It's the sixth largest company in the world based on revenue. It is, they generated $400 billion of revenue, which is a ton. But the thing about it is that the profit margins that they have are so astronomical. Of that $400 billion, $105 billion was profit. So you're talking about a 25% profit margin, which is massive when it comes to business. A lot of like grocery stores run by on like 1% profit margins, you know, very, very small margins, but you do volume and you make up for it and the fact that you do a lot of volume. Well, when it comes to companies like Aramco, they do both. Volume and profit margin. So they're making a ton of money. It's the most profitable company in the world. Aramco is the most profitable company, publicly traded company in the world. And it is the third largest company in terms of market capitalization in the world behind Apple and Microsoft. So it's a big one. It just recently went public. Recently, I don't know, 5 years ago went public, but for a long, long time, it was private. When they went public, I think they raised $2 trillion, I think. Or was that what? Their market cap is $2 trillion. They raised, I think, maybe $1 trillion or something. A lot of money, right? But of course, you can. Largest daily oil production of any company in the world. They have, Aramco has the world's second largest proven crude oil reserves at 270 billion barrels that they have access to. I mean, this is a juggernaut. They can go on forever. They operate the world's largest natural gas fields, both onshore and offshore, with 288 trillion cubic feet of natural gas underneath. So they've got crude oil and they've got natural gas. Take your pick. So they're a dual threat here. And it was a group of oil companies that originally made up Aramco, but over time the Saudi government just started buying into this. They bought 25% of Aramco in 1973, then they bought another 60% a year later, and they bought the rest in 1976. So the Saudi government basically owns the company, essentially, at this point. And 70% of Aramco's sales go to Asia, right? So again, if you're America and you come up with this deal, this petrodollar arrangement for the Saudis, man, you just create this unbelievable demand for your dollars. That's why when we talk about the petrodollar arrangement coming to an end and what a disaster that would be for America, I don't think people really have stop to comprehend what this actually means. It means that this arrangement with these 270 billion barrels, future barrels that have yet to come out of the ground, or this natural gas, this is all going to be traded in something else other than dollars. The dollar will be unnecessary. If you could keep the dollar relevant as a petrodollar, as that arrangement, and pull the next 270 billion barrels out of the ground for Aramco, you would have the dollar would be relevant until the last barrel of oil was pulled out of the ground. But if you destroy that arrangement, which Joe Biden seems intent on doing, and MBS is more than happy to help him with it, you're going to create a catastrophe of hyperinflation back in the United States, which is probably what they're working on anyway. Aramco was producing 8.6 million barrels 20 years ago. So they've been doing this for a long time. It's almost incomprehensible how much money they have. And according to the environmentalists, Aramco is responsible for 4% of the global greenhouse gas emissions since 1965. But the government says that they're going to be net zero by 2060. Okay, whatever. Yeah, I don't necessarily believe that that's a realistic thing. Let's talk about something else. Let's talk about the Saudi Public Investment Fund, the PIF. Now, this is a sovereign wealth fund from the Saudis that they use to take these profits from the oil industry and use them for a variety of different investments. So they have currently these numbers are so big that you throw them around and they sound unreal. But the Saudi Public Investment Fund, think of it like a bank account that they have to go out and invest in a variety of things to make them a little bit less dependent on oil in the future and a little bit more diversified. They have $700 billion in this account to play with. Okay. So when you hear, we're going to get into like the entertainment thing. When you hear like Live Golf being filmed, like, oh, the Saudis started this golf league to compete with the PGA, and they funded it with an astounding $2 billion to get it off the ground. That $2 billion came out of an account that has $700 billion in it. So it's nothing to them. It's quite literally nothing. It's just amazing. So it's the largest sovereign wealth fund. It's $700 billion under management. They have they expect that to be $1.07 trillion under management just in 2 years. They're going to put another $300 billion into this thing. It's crazy. They're using it as an investment vehicle to pivot away from this very extraordinary opportunity that they've had geographically to just be sitting on top of oil, a resource that we've decided is worth something and used for just about everything. And this country seems to have just had the luck, and that's in air quotes, of being on top of it. You got to be careful with this luck, though, because, you know, you attract the wrong kind of attention when you have this. So it was started in 1971 by King Faisal, who was assassinated a couple of years later. It was reborn in March of 2015 with Resolution 270, which placed the fund under the control of the Council of Economic and Development Affairs, which is important because Mohammed bin Salman is in charge of the Council of Economic and Development Affairs, and he went ahead and moved the PIF underneath that. So now he controls it. So the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Saudi Arabia is now fully under the control of Mohammed bin Salman. Okay. And this is known as the program. The program is being used to diversify away from being fully dependent on oil and gas. That's part of the program. It's described as a roadmap for the advancement of Vision 2030. Oh, 2030, you say? What a surprise. I would have never guessed that they would pick that benchmark date to start. So Vision 2030 is using funds from the program to develop public service sectors such as health, education, infrastructure, recreation, and tourism. So basically, they want to soften the hardcore religious image that Saudi Arabia has, rightfully so, and transform themselves into like the, I don't know, Agenda 2030 version of Dubai, sort of free market, weird eco-communism, you'll own nothing and you'll eat the bugs sort of thing. We're all going to live in the yellow submarine and we're not going to have oil. We're going to be green, which is weird coming from the Saudis considering they made all their money in oil. It all just seems very World Economic Forum-ish, United Nations to me, because of the 2030. I don't think that's a surprise. So they're diversifying away from oil, which they should, at least. I'm not saying get out of the oil business, obviously, but just diversify. You've got 40% of your GDP coming from the oil and gas industry, so it's smart strategically. But but again, this whole plan is predicated on $80 a barrel oil. So you got to get it up to $80 a barrel. Anything less than that, and you're going to be, these are all just going to be dreams instead of reality. But there's three parts to this Vision 2030. They say they want to make the country the, quote, heart of the Arab and Islamic worlds. Okay. I don't know what that means necessarily, but they want to make Saudi Arabia the heart of it. I guess it kind of makes sense. You've got Mecca there. You're sort of the birthplace of Islam, and it does make sense. But I think what Saudi Arabia has watched is the United Arab Emirates pivot from a very geographically small country that has a tremendous amount of oil and take those resources and say, well, let's create Dubai. Let's build out that. Let's build out Abu Dhabi. Let's build out these airports. Let's become an international hub for travel. Let's become a finance, the Switzerland of the Middle East. Let's do some things differently here. So Saudi Arabia has watched the role of United Arab Emirates over the last 20 years sort of take off, and they want in on the action. Now, of course, they've got the money to do it. So they've got this Vision 2030. Make the country the heart of the Arab and Islamic worlds, number one. Number two, become a global investment powerhouse, again, much like Dubai. And number three, to transform into the hub of Africa and Eurasia. Every time I hear Eurasia, I immediately think of Zbigniew Brzezinski talking about the global chessboard, you know, and how Eurasia is the key to it. Afghanistan is what he was talking about specifically, but that intersection of the Middle East and Europe and Asia all coming into this one place. And Saudi Arabia wants in on the action. And so they have decided that they're going to do things a little bit differently. And they've gotten into the entertainment industry. Have you noticed this? It's been happening lately. This is clearly an MBS decision. Concerts are now happening there. Even Toby Keith played there, which is kind of weird. They have the MDL Beast Music Festival. Just don't get caught with ecstasy or don't cut your fucking head off. Cristiano Ronaldo just signed with Al Nassr for $214 million. Kareem Benzema signed last week for $200 million with a Saudi club. The Saudis are pushing for the World Cup in 2030 with Egypt and Greece as partners for that. I don't know if that's going to actually happen, but they want that. I think they saw what happened in Doha over the last summer when they were able to have the World Cup there in 2022. And they said, well, listen, it was in the Middle East and it wound up working fine. Yes, we had to send the Budweiser cargo ship back because it had all this alcohol that we're not allowing them to sell here. But, you know, mistakes were made. The PIF owns 80% of Newcastle United Football Club and just acquired 75% stakes in four different Saudi football clubs, soccer teams. So they're getting in on that. This is sort of a dual, I don't know. There's multiple benefits to them. First, diversification. Great. Second, become known as an entertainment hub, right? With these great soccer players that you can buy at the end of their career and use them. This has been going on for a long, long time. Teams have done this for sort of publicity thing. You know, you sign Gretzky at the end of his career, you sign Brett Favre at the end of his career, you sign Cristiano Ronaldo at the end of his career and take him to Saudi Arabia and throw so much money at him, he can't say no. And you do this, so it kind of benefits to, hey, look, we're in the entertainment industry. But there's another factor, and that's sort of the whitewashing of the Saudi crimes that's happening in this as well. They want you to think about them in a different way. They're buying reputation management. They're buying this. They want, it's part of the plan. It's part of what they realize. They recognize what they're viewed as around the world. as head chopping lunatics that are sitting on a ton of oil and driving Rolls Royces everywhere. That's what they're known for. And I don't think they're going to get away from that anytime soon, but they just would prefer that you focus on Ronaldo instead. So they went out and bought him. Or LIV Golf. I mentioned that. Let's talk about that. They created their own league, their own golf league, to compete with the PGA Tour. And for those of you that aren't sports fans, it was a big problem for the PGA. It created a divide right down the middle. And the LIV Golf said, listen, I mentioned that they've got $2 billion to play with. And they said, spend this money to create the golf league that you think you'd want to, that you think would be, you know, taking golf to the new level. It's a weird format. Some of them are teams, like golfers that are competing as a team against other teams of golfers. It's very unique. It's, in fact, I'm not even saying it's a bad thing necessarily to have a new take on golf and to play tournaments in different areas. They don't have a television deal, or the television deal they had in America was awful. It was like on the CW or something, like it's like Buffy the Vampire Slayer and then like LIV Golf or something. I don't know. It was really, really shitty TV deal. They took all this money and went out and said, well, we need to get some prominent players from the PGA Tour to come join us to validate this new league that we're running. And if you and I started a new league, a new golf league, and we said, hey, Phil Mickelson, would you like to come over here and play in our new golf league? He would say, no, thank you. You guys don't have the money to build it out the way you should, but the Saudis do. And so what the Saudis did is they said, hey, Phil Mickelson, would you like to come play in our new golf league? And he said, I don't know. What's the offer? And they said, well, we'll give you $200 million today if you agree to join. And he said, I'm sorry, what? They said, yeah, we'll give you, your signing bonus for joining this league is $200 million. Phil Mickelson put that in his pocket. They didn't stop with him. Dustin Johnson, I mentioned Gretzky, married to Paulina Gretzky. He probably had the conversation with Wayne. Wayne was with the Edmonton Oilers back in the World Hockey League, and they got acquired by the NHL. He probably said, hey, listen, man, go to LIV, take the money. Eventually, it'll merge into the PGA. They gave Dustin Johnson a $150 million signing bonus. Bryson DeChambeau, $125 million. Brooks Koepka, $100 million. Cam Smith, $100 million. These are signing bonuses to come to this league. When you play a golf tournament for LIV, there's 14 golf tournaments. There is a total of $405 million in prize money available in these 14 golf tournaments for the 48 golfers. 48 golfers are going to split up $405 million in prize money. But just so you know, if you're a member of LIV Golf and you play in this tournament, you're one of these 48 golfers, and you try your damn best this weekend, and you finish in last place. Last place pays $120,000. That's what you get for finishing last in these tournaments. So not only do you get the signing bonus, not only do you get the payment for finishing just in last place, you get paid for, you know, finishing higher. The yearly champion, the individual champ, got an $18 million bonus for finishing in first place over the course of the year. So again, you have to look at this as a push into the entertainment industry. They're doing it with concerts. They're doing it with soccer/football. They're doing it with golf. And get ready, because they're not done. They're getting into Formula One. So start to envision a scene where it's not just Monaco and these places that have traditionally hosted Formula One. It's real big in Europe, but now you're starting to see it move to the Middle East and places like United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. They're getting involved in it. They're getting involved in boxing. They're getting involved in MMA. They're getting involved with WWE. They're getting involved with sports. Are you okay with that? Does it matter to you? Do you give a shit? Now, kind of wrap up this entertainment and LIV Golf component, there has been big news recently LIV Golf was getting sued by the PGA. PGA said, "You, this is, I don't know, unfair practice. I don't know what the but it was the Saudis said, sue us. That's fine. We'll fight you in court as long as we need to." Did we mention that they have $700 million in their bank account just waiting to be used on a variety of things? Does the PGA Tour have that much money sitting? No, they don't. So they wound up in a situation where the PGA Tour was suing the Saudis and LIV Golf for infringement on this. And they'd already racked up $100 million of legal fees. And they get themselves into a situation where they realize if you can't beat them, join them. And so they held a conversation with the Saudis and they said, we need to end these lawsuits right now for a variety of reasons. One, the PGA was getting bled dry. Two, with discovery, they're going to find out that there was massive collusion going on with the PGA Tour to try and prevent the Saudis from getting access to these golfers. And I guarantee you it was going to put them in a bad light. And they didn't want that information coming out because they knew they were guilty as fuck of being involved in doing stuff like that. So they merged. It's in the process. It's a relatively new thing. They're still operating this year. LIV said, we're still going to play the 2023 season, golf season, as the way we'd been planning it. Nothing's going to change, but we're going to hammer out the details so that next year, 2024, the PGA Tour and the LIV Tour are all, and the DP Tour in Europe are all part of the same group. Now, how that'll look, I don't know. But the Saudis won this one. And you know who really won is Phil Mickelson. He put $200 million in his pocket and he's going to wind up back playing against the same guys in the same group anyway. After all, Tiger Woods reportedly turned down the LIV Golf offer. Tiger Woods' offer was $700 million and he said no. I bet he and Rory are kicking themselves right now. Could have had that money, but everybody hates Rory, so nobody gives a fuck about him. Let's move on to the investment projects, okay? The program, let's talk about what they're involved in, right? So you've got 700 bill to play with, and you can sprinkle that around. You can create LIV Golf tournaments for $2 billion, which seems like an astounding amount of money until you realize how much they really have to play with. You sprinkle this money around and put it into different things. So the program has invested, they own 5% of Uber. They own 5% of Capcom, the video game maker. They own 5% of Live Nation. And they own minor stakes, though when I say minor stakes, it's still multi-billion dollar stakes in Facebook, Meta, Boeing, and Citigroup. So they're again tied with America in a variety of ways. Let's talk about their big plans. They have big plans. When you've got big money, you can afford to have big plans, and they certainly do. They want to build out. I mentioned that they want to go sort of the direction that Abu Dhabi and Dubai have gone, building out massive international airports, building out infrastructure projects, building out hotels, conventions, entertainment, but also sort of the financial marketplace. What did they say? That their global investment powerhouse is number two on their list of things to do. They want every bank to have a headquarters in their new area, in their smart city. They're building a place called Neom, N-E-O-M, Neom Smart City. It translates to new future, the new future. So it's in the northwest. If you can envision Saudi Arabia on the map, this is in the northwestern quadrant of it, along the Red Sea. This project, this Neom Smart City, was announced in January of 2019, so relatively new. It's made up of an economic zone, a big economic zone, a big economic zone. This region is 100. So think of it like this: it ends at the waters. It's bordered on its western side by the Red Sea. It then extends inland 100 miles and then down south 100 miles and then back towards the sea 100 miles. So it makes a 10,000 square mile block, big square, that's bordered on the western side by the Red Sea. And the rest is just this, it's just desert, right? Desert that's being converted into an economic zone. And what's going to happen in this economic zone? Well, all kinds of things. They've got a plans for a project called Oxagon, which is a floating, I don't know why they have to make it float with all that desert out there, but a floating industrial complex shaped like an octagon and featuring desalinization plants and all kinds of industrial capacity there. And that, just that octagon floating industrial complex will be 90 square miles. So a 90 square mile island they're planning on building. They're going to build the Neom Bay airport, which is going to be an international airport. Think of Dubai. Think of something similar to that. Agricultural wise, they have 16,000 acres, which seems relatively small, if you ask me, considering how much they plan to do with this region, but 16,000 acres that they say rely heavily on, quote, genetically engineered crops. But of course, that should be no surprise because this is this administration in regime, however you want to describe the MBS group, they have ties to the World Economic Forum. So the fact that they're working on genetically engineered crops should come as no surprise to anybody. And they're also working on a project that you might have heard of called The Line. This is a linear city. You saw the plans for it, maybe, if you were paying attention. Over the last, maybe 6 months ago, they rolled it out. A linear city, 112 miles long, and then 200 meters wide, 660 feet wide. So a long building that stretches, I said 112, 110 miles. You're going to have to sort of use your imagination on this. Imagine, if you will, a building that is 110 miles long and 660 feet or 200 meters wide. Pretty narrow, but it goes on like forever. Like the distance between, almost the distance between outskirts of Los Angeles to Vegas, just a city that just keeps going and going and going and going. So it's one continuous structure with mirrored sides and glass made of made of steel, but with mirrored sides that look like glass. If you haven't seen this thing, you got to go look it up. You got to take a look. Just called The Line, Saudi Arabia, Neom Smart City. If you search those things, it'll pull it up. It's a car-free city. It's going to be large enough to house 9 million prisoners. Residents, sorry. It's going to be a walkable, gerbil tube? I don't know. The whole thing sounds really dystopian, like a hellscape to me, and like a prison. And they're like, well, you're going to be free to travel this whole line. Are you, though? Are you going to be free to leave it? That's my question. Can you get out once you get everybody in there? You've got 9 million people, and you know where they are. Now, again, just to put this in perspective, this sounds crazy, man. Like the idea that they're going to build a 110-mile long building, like what's that going to cost? What is a 90 square mile in floating industrial complex cost? What is one of these big ass airports cost? I know they cost a lot. Like how much money do you have to build build out a structure that's 100 miles by 100 miles? Like, how much money do you have? Well, the answer is $500 billion, $500 billion. They have set aside for this. This is what they've got to work with. So the answer is they've got a lot of money. And of course, they intend to have this project generate a fortune for them as well, right? So they're not just building this to just to build it. I mean, they're building this to launder money, more than likely, probably. I don't know. I just threw that in there. I'm sure there's going to be a ton of money laundering going on. It feels like an opportunity for some wonderful money washing, if you ask me. But, or I don't know, maybe we call it the Woke Belt and Road Initiative, because it's got some of that same feel to it. And the Saudis are deeply involved with the Chinese. We're going to get to that in a little bit. But, you know, it's with $500 billion, you've got a lot of money to play with, but they need it. They need it. Of course they need the money to create these systems that they're building. The smart city is going to take like 40 years to build out, they think. And they need it to try and whitewash the crimes of Mohammed bin Salman. They need to make him seem as visionary as the former head of the United Arab Emirates, which they've written, you know, glowing reviews about how he was such a visionary and things like that. I think, you know, obviously distracts away from the Jamal Khashoggi ordered murder by MBS, the hit on him. So, you know, now the Saudis really are starting to talk to people like the Iranians and the Chinese and the Israelis. And I got news for you. This would never have happened under the Bush years from 1988 to 2008, HW and W Bush. There is no way in hell that the Saudis would have been putting together deals with the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Israelis while the Bushes were managing that relationship. And you know how I know? Because they were so close with the Saudis that they practically adopted one of them. Let's talk about Bandar Bush. Bandar bin Sultan al-Saud, otherwise known as Bandar Bush. A guy so close to the Bush family that they fucking adopted him. Okay? A diplomat, ambassador to the United States from 1983 to 2005. That's a long time. 83 to 2005, you've got Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Bush Jr., all in that during that time frame when Bandar Bush was the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States. So what do you do when you're the ambassador to the United States? Well, if you're Bandar Bush, you become an arms dealer, an influence peddler, which he was and did. And with royal family connections that he had, he was a royal himself, to the Bush family, which is, you know, in a way, weird way, kind of American royalty. I hate, despise the Bush families, but you have, I don't think the average American has an idea of how powerful the Bush family was. I would refer you back to when Rockefeller and Kissinger opened up China for American enterprise. They did so with George H.W. Bush as well. And when George H.W. Bush was involved in that, he was setting up the reports that I heard was 5,000 industrial facilities that the Bush family set up in China. Okay. I can't confirm that. Those are the numbers that I've read. Even if it's a fraction of that, it's a lot. So the Bush family, We don't need to get into their history. Brown Brothers, Harriman, trading with the enemy, financing Adolf Hitler through that bank with Prescott Bush and all the shenanigans. But this is a powerful American family, the Bush family, and the Saudis. And so together with them, it was a match made in hell. You've got Bandar Bush was the head director general of the Saudi intelligence agency. So he's the head. Again, it's like H.W. Bush was the head of the CIA. Bandar Bush was the head of the Saudi CIA. And they did deals together. He sold weapons for Reagan. He then skimmed money to give to the CIA. Part of Bandar Bush's job was to, from these weapons trades, to skim money and make sure you're using that for the CIA. He's very tight connections to oil into Aramco. He was deeply involved with BCCI, which is affectionately known as the Bank for Crooks and Criminals International, which was the CIA's offshore bank that was shut down. He was involved in funding the Contras. The Iran-Contra affair involved Bandar Bush. He was used by Nancy Reagan as a back channel to the Saudi royal family during this whole era of the 80s when Reagan was in. This guy's a player, a legit player. And let's bring it up to sort of a little bit more modern day. He was deeply involved with the planning of 9/11 with the George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, all the Zionicons there. And he was in charge of picking the fall guys. That's why the Saudis were so involved in the, you know, the 19 Arab hijackers with box cutters and passports. Who made that happen? Bandar Bush made that happen. That's why he was there. You got to have somebody you could trust. They trusted him. So when the U.S., Israelis, and Saudis got together to plan 9/11, the guy planning it from the Saudi side was Bandar Bush. And as part of this, you know, listen, he sold in the aftermath of 9/11, think of what happened. Billions and billions of dollars of arms were sold and used on Afghanistan, in Iraq, and a variety of other countries. And who was involved in selling these arms to various countries? Bandar Bush. You know, so again, this is the relationship. This is a guy that was his very last role, a Secretary General, National Security Council, deep state to his core. And I think it's important for us to know that and to understand that, because if you know who Bandar Bush is and you know his relationships to the Bush family and the House of Saud, and you know where he came out of and the positions that he held and the fact that he was an arms trader and he was obviously a spy. I mean, ambassador spy, what's the difference? And his role in 9/11 and continued role in American government from that point forward, you just have to know that the Saudis and the United States have a lot of skeletons in their closet. Fuck, in maybe real ones too, given that H.W. Bush was a skull and bones man, probably drinking blood out of Geronimo's skull, you know, probably drinking baby blood in the crypt at Yale at Skull and Bones. But these guys do have a lot of proverbial skeletons in their closet. And as this relationship with the Saudis sort of unwinds on the America side, keep in mind, they're your co-conspirators. It's like you robbed a bank with them. You know what I mean? You did 9/11 with these guys. Be very careful how you end this relationship. Because if they want to blow the whistle on you and drag all of America's dirty secrets out into the light for people to start examining them, they can do that. So it's an interesting, you know, it's interesting to look at where Saudi Arabia is headed. Because in order to understand where it's headed, you need to kind of know the backstory of how involved they are with America. This isn't just like a country that you used to do deals with. This is a country that you did 9/11 with, and all the ramifications of that. So this is the Spider-Man meme where everyone's pointing at each other. They're all involved in it. There are no good guys in this scenario. You know, people are like, oh, MBS is such a bad guy. Of course he is. They're all bad guys. You. The price of admission into this club is you've got to be a bad guy. We should understand that at this point. Let's talk about the future of Saudi Arabia, their policy towards America in particular. They are moving away from the U.S. We've seen that recently. They have no respect for Joe Biden. Why should they? He's weak and demented, and they don't trust who's actually running the show, which is more than likely Obama. They don't like Obama. They've never liked Obama. So they don't like Biden either. And so they're sort of going off on their own. They're starting to get involved in Syria and Iran and starting to reconnect old relationships that they had with Syria and Iran that have faded. And they're maybe putting the old gang back together. They're at least opening up lines of communication with these countries that had shut down for a while. And the Iranian embassy I should say, reopened in Saudi Arabia after being closed for the last 7 years. So when Trump was running things, it had been closed. And now they're reopening it. They said, well, it's time to talk to the Iranians again. And it's maybe, you know, not wait till the last minute to build that bridge again. And now we have OPEC Plus putting in production cuts in order to boost the value of the oil above $80 a barrel. We talked about that. Like, look, they want oil high. They want it high. And in order to get it high, they've got to, you could do a couple things. You can create conflicts around the world, which they do, of course, which we do, or you can create, you can just cut the amount that you produce and cause there to be a production shortage and therefore the price to spike. And that's kind of where we are with that. In 2019, so let's just say recently, the U.S. announced, or documentation came out supporting the fact that the United States imports 500,000 barrels of crude oil from Saudi Arabia every single day, meaning 182 million barrels of oil a year. The United States buys that from the Saudis. 500,000 barrels of crude oil a day is a lot of oil for America to buy from the Saudis. But it's not as much as it used to be. It used to be 2 million barrels a day. But that's not the situation any longer. You know who buys 2 million barrels a day? Of course you do. The Chinese. Because we've talked about it a ton on this show. That works out to more than a quarter of everything that Saudi Arabia is producing goes to China. Used to go to America. Now it goes to China. So my question is this. Petrodollar or petroyuan? Because if we're going to go back by the business model that the United States and Saudi Arabia put together in the 70s, then it should be the petroyuan, because they're the ones that are buying all the oil. I mean, 500,000 barrels is not nothing, but it's not 2 million. And the Chinese have recognized that. And this relationship is starting to blossom between the Chinese and the Saudis. And that could be a problem. But they've partnered on the Belt and Road Initiative. We've talked about that. And Saudi Arabia just signed investment, 30 investment agreements with China worth $10 billion. That happened last week. So they're moving. They're moving this direction. You got the CIA director, William Burns. He said that the United States, quote, has felt blindsided by Riyadh's approach to Iran and Syria, two nations under U.S. Sanctions. Oh, you felt blindsided that Saudis are talking to them? Well, maybe you guys in America, maybe William Burns, CIA director, and all the Biden administration guys should get their heads out of their asses and pay attention to what's going on. This should come as a surprise to nobody. You've got Iran, China, MBS, and Russia all talking, all working together. I'm telling you, there's a future for Saudi Arabia that's going to look very different, but they're going to have to be careful with how they unwind themselves from this arrangement. This is like those surgeons that are very specialized at untangling brain aneurysms. And if you make one mistake, the patient dies, and you can't do that. So this relationship between the Americans and the Saudis that had been brewing and had been a working relationship for a very, very long time has turned recently. And that has implications for a lot of people. And look, if you're curious to know what Saudi Arabia is up to with regard to all of these things that they're interested in, I'll leave it with this one little tidbit. Jeffrey Epstein had a Saudi passport. I'm just saying. Hey, fist bump, everybody, just like Biden. If you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can reach out to me through the website, theoctopusofglobalcontrol.com. You can follow me on Twitter @macroaggressions. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you again soon.